If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. You can make money from your podcast as well with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. What are you waiting for? Before I get into today's episode, we have to talk. Have you heard of Fruit of the Bean Coffee? Their coffee is roasted right after you order and shipped directly to you for maximum freshness. Fruit of the Bean believes in giving back. 10% of their net profits go to support orphans and those affected by human trafficking, which is so wonderful. If you order from fruitofthebean.com, you can use my code SPOOKY, S-P-O-O-K-Y, and get 25% off of your purchase. Go to fruitofthebean.com today. Welcome back to All the Things That Keep Us Up at Night. We are on episode 2 of the West Memphis 3, and I'm going to start on the suspects. Suspect number 1, the man at the Bojangles restaurant. On May 5th of 1993 at 8:40 p.m., the West Memphis Police Department got a phone call that a black man who was bleeding had come into the Bojangles restaurant about 30 minutes earlier, and he went into the women's bathroom. This restaurant is located near where the boys' bodies were found that next day. Officer Regina Meek got to the Bojangles at 8:50 p.m. and questioned the manager of the restaurant, Marty King, through the drive-thru window. Marty described the man as a 5'11 black male, thin, dirty, late 20s. He also had a blue cast type of brace on his arm that had white Velcro on it. He said the man had muddy feet, wore a white cap, black pants, a blue shirt, and had blood on his face and arm. He said the man seemed mentally disoriented, not on drugs or anything like that, but just mentally disoriented. But the man left right before the officer got there. Employees went into the bathroom and saw blood smeared on the wall. Officer Meek leaves the Bojangles around 9 p.m. and never even went inside the restaurant. The next day, Detective Byrne Ridge and Sergeant Mike Allen go to the Bojangles and collect blood scrapings from that bathroom wall. The scrapings were never sent to a crime lab to be analyzed, and later, the scrapings were reported lost. What? Most of these cases, the cops just don't do their job correctly. It frustrates me to no end. So, the blood scrapings from that bathroom were eventually lost. They were never analyzed. No additional interviews were ever conducted with any Bojangles employees about that incident. Critics of the Bojangles theory also points out that the bleeding man reportedly did wear a cast on one arm, something that people claim would make it difficult to tie up and murder three little boys. What I want to know is, do you think it's still possible? Just because something may be seen as difficult doesn't really make it impossible. But what do you think? Suspect number 2, Terry Hobbs, who is the stepfather of Stevie Branch and his friend David Jacoby, with possible help of 2 teenagers. There was a documentary film about the 1993 slayings called West of Memphis. The documentary suggests Terry Hobbs participated in the murders. Filmmakers note that a significant piece of DNA evidence found at the crime scene, which was a hair found in one of the shoelaces used to hogtie these children, matched the DNA of Terry Hobbs, a second hair found at the scene on a tree stump near where the bodies were found, matched David. David was a friend of Terry's. Terry visited David roughly an hour before the boys disappeared. They questioned Terry's alibi that he spent the evening of the slayings with David. In the film, David doubts whether he spent that much time with Terry as Terry suggested. Filmmakers also point out that Terry Hobbs had a long history of abuse, including admitting to assault on his wife, and there are accusations of child beating and assaults on neighbors. One of Stevie's aunts, Judy Sadler, accused Terry in the documentary of forcing his young son to watch him masturbate and accused him of sexually molesting Stevie's sister, Amanda. Terry denies a neighbor's accusation of seeing him with the boys on the night of the killings. Another aunt of Stevie's says that she saw Terry Hobbs the night of the killings doing laundry, allegedly to clean the mud off of his clothes after murdering the 3 8-year-olds. And the fact that Stevie's pocket knife, one he almost always had with him, was later found in Terry's possessions. Perhaps most damningly, the filmmakers talked to 3 young men who claimed to have been told by a nephew of Terry's that the fact that Terry killed Stevie, Michael, and Christopher was a closely guarded family secret. Under oath, the 3 young men said, "Michael Hobbs told them, my uncle killed 3 boys in West Memphis." John Byers is shown calling Terry a baby killer outside of an Arkansas courtroom. Now, John Byers was also a suspect after the trial. A lot of people suspected him as being involved. Terry did have defenders. Todd Moore, Christopher Moore's father, said the evidence against Terry was not persuasive. He said Michael spent a lot of time at the Hobbs home and could have easily picked up the hair found in his shoelaces on one of those occasions. Todd Moore says, quote, "Terry Hobbs did not murder my son. No credible law enforcement officer believes so," end quote. In 2013, separate affidavits were signed by Billy Wayne Stewart and Benny Guy. The amount of detail and the plausibility of the stories told in the affidavits make it seem very credible, even if they do come from an admitted drug dealer and a convicted felon. On May 5th, 1993, according to both Billy and Benny, Terry Hobbs, David Jacoby, and 2 teenagers named L.G. Hollingsworth and Buddy Lucas popped up at Billy's home. They were looking to buy pot, which Billy provided. As Billy was selling the pot, he saw Terry and David making out in a truck across the street. Billy says Terry was a bisexual who preferred sex with young boys. Terry stated he had invited Billy's 10-year-old son to pool parties, and Billy insisted his son decline. In April of 1995, what happened on that May 5th of 93 was told to Billy by Buddy Lucas. Terry, David, Buddy, and LG got into the truck and rode around town. They were smoking pot and drinking whiskey. They eventually went down a dirt road by Blue Beacon Wood. According to Buddy, Terry asked LG and Buddy to get out and wrestle while he and David watched. Now, Buddy never said that the wrestling turned into anything sexual involving himself, LG, and the 2 men, but Billy Stewart has no doubt that's what happened, because he said Buddy lowered his head and shame was all over his face as he told the story. It made it more clear to Billy that there was more going on between both the boys and the men than what Buddy had just told him. It is likely that during this sexual activity that Christopher, Stevie, and Michael rode up on their bicycles in the wrong place and at the wrong time. Billy said, according to Buddy, who is the teenager, one of the teenagers, Terry screamed, "Get those little fuckers!" While David beat on one of the children, Terry ordered Buddy and LG, the two teenagers, to pull off his pants. According to the Billy Stewart affidavit, quote, Mr. Terry Hobbs walked over to the boy that Mr. David Jacoby had been beating and continuously bit the boy's penis and scrotum, then cut the boy's genitals, end quote. Terry then said the other two children had to be killed because they saw too much. Terry and David did just that. The boys' clothes and bodies were gathered and dragged to the water. Their bicycles were thrown into the bayou. I'm sorry if you hear my dog barking in the background. I'm so sorry. According to Billy Stewart, he tried calling the West Memphis police investigator, Bill Sanders, to tell him everything Buddy Lucas told him. For some reason, Bill Sanders never returned Billy's phone calls. Benny Guy's affidavit told a similar story. Benny stated that Buddy Lucas was, quote, pretty bad slow, end quote, and confessed to his involvement in the slayings to him in 1994. Benny said in his affidavit that L.G. Hollingsworth confessed to participating in the killings as well, while both were in the Crittenden County Jail in 1995. L.G.'s confession did add a few more details than Buddy's. According to Benny Guy's account of L.G.'s confession, Terry Hobbs became full of rage after one of the 8-year-old boys started to kick him. Terry hit the boy in the head and shouted, quote, I'm gonna teach your fucking ass, end quote. LG stated that he, Buddy, Terry, and David all beat the 3 8-year-old boys and confirmed Buddy's statement that Terry ordered him and Buddy to remove the pants of the 3 boys before cutting one of the boys' genitals with his knife. Benny Guy also sent a detailed letter to prosecutor Scott Ellington in February of 2012 telling the details of the 2 confessions, but Scott Ellington never responded. Suspects number 3. The West Memphis 3? It was May 7th, 1993, and Steve Jones, who was a juvenile officer who first discovered the bodies, interviewed a local troubled teen named Damian Eccles. Damian had been under the watchful eye of Jerry Driver, another juvenile officer, for some time. Damian Eccles was a 17-year-old dropout with a history of psychiatric issues, including major depression. Damian dressed in black, wrote dark poems, had long hair, a tattoo on his upper arm, and described himself as Wiccan. In the past few years, Damian allegedly threatened his ex-girlfriend and the guy she was dating at the time, as well as the guy's father. We have to talk about Fruit of the Bean Coffee. Their coffee is roasted right after you order and shipped directly to you for maximum freshness. Fruit of the Bean also believes in giving back. 10% of their net profits go to support orphans and those affected by human trafficking. If you order from fruitofthebean.com, you can use my code SPOOKY, S-P-O-O-K-Y, and get 25% off of your purchase. So go to fruitofthebean.com today. That's FRUITOFTHEBEAN.com. And get 25% off using my code SPOOKY, and 10% of their net profits will go to support orphans and those affected by human trafficking. So with this, there's no way you can lose. It's a win-win situation, so go order your coffee now. What are you waiting for? Go! Damian stayed several months with his mom in Oregon in 1992. He had been admitted during that stay to a psych ward and placed under suicide watch. Now, rumors started to spread that the murders may have been the work of devil worshippers. Inspector Gitchell did nothing to stop the rumors, as he told reporters that his department was investigating the possibility that the killings were connected with cult activity. The West Memphis Police Department even assigned the case number 93-05-0666 to the murder file. Damien went back to Arkansas in the fall of 1992. He briefly entered a juvenile detention center. He was then sent to a psych hospital in Little Rock after biting and attempting to suck the blood from an arm of another detainee. After his release from the psych hospital, Damien went back to West Memphis. He met regularly with a social worker at a mental health facility. The social worker put in her notes that Damien Eccles told her he might become another Charles Manson or Ted Bundy. Jerry Driver was convinced that Damien might have a lot to do with the murders. So Jerry pushed his suspicions onto the West Memphis Police Department. The police questioned Damien Eccles about the murders three separate times, between May 7th and May 10th. Twice at his home and once at the police station. Damien stated to investigators that he had never heard of the three boys, and whoever committed the murders was sick. Damien said he spent the evening of May 5th at home with his mom, talking on the phone with two girlfriends in Memphis. Lieutenant James Sudbury reported that Damien stated, "The killer is probably a local that wouldn't run." He noted that Damien enjoyed reading books by Stephen King and has EVIL across his left knuckles. Damien willingly took a polygraph test. And let me just say here, polygraph tests are not reliable. They are not reliable and they are not admissible in most courts. So, I don't trust polygraph test as much as I don't trust a lot of eyewitnesses, and that's just from my study of different cases. The amount of falsehoods that come out of polygraph test and eyewitness accounts, they just are sometimes not credible. So Damien did willingly take a polygraph, and the administrating officer concluded that he recorded significant responses indicative of deception. In addition to Damien Eccles, investigators had their attention focused on Jason Baldwin, who was a friend of Damien's, who also had evil inked across his left knuckles. Like Damien, Jason denied any involvement in the murders. Detectives increasingly thought otherwise. A local waitress named Vicky told police she suspected the murders were, in fact, cult-related, and she was willing to play detective. Vicky believed her connection to a 17-year-old named Jesse Miskelly, who at times babysat for her and mowed her lawn, might give an opportunity for her to explore the secret life of Damien Eccles. So, Vicky told police that Jesse Miskelly, who was, quote, mildly mentally retarded, end quote, had said to her about Damien, his friend who, quote, drank blood and stuff, end quote. The West Memphis Police Department gave her permission to play detective. Vicky asked Jesse to arrange an introduction to Damien, who she said she'd like to go out with. Jesse agreed to it and shortly brought Damien over to Vicky's home and introduced them to each other. What exactly went down between Vicky and Damien became clear years later, which we will talk about. But for the local law enforcement's benefit, Vicky told quite the tale. Vicky told investigators that on the night of May 19th, she and Jesse were driven by Damien in a red Ford Escort. Keep in mind, that's weird because Damien didn't have a car and never was known to even drive. But that Damien drove them to an S-bot, or an S-bat, which is a gathering of witches. It was allegedly in a field outside of town where she saw 10 young people, each having their faces and arms painted black. stripping their clothes, and touching each other. Bicky claimed the ones participating in the orgy used nicknames such as Snake, Spider, and Lucifer. Vicky was offended by the naked activity and asked Damien to drive her home, according to her, which he did, and left Jesse at the orgy. Vicky and her 8-year-old son, Aaron, met with the detective in late May. Vicky shared her story about the SBAT when Aaron piped up telling authorities that he, Michael, Stevie, and Christopher used to visit Robin Hood Woods, and during one visit there, they saw 5 men sitting in a circle chanting and doing, quote, what men and ladies do, end quote. Vicky was administered a polygraph on June 2nd by the West Memphis Police. Polygraph Administrator Bill Durham reported that Vicky was telling the truth. They were so convinced by her polygraph that police picked up Jesse Miss Kelly for questioning at 9 a.m. the very next day. They told Jesse there was a $35,000 reward for information leading to convictions in the case, and if he were to help them solve the case, that his family would be eligible for the money. During yet another polygraph interview, and I can't express my dislike and how much I don't put faith in polygraphs enough. I absolutely can't stress it enough. They're unreliable. But Jesse initially denied having anything to do with the satanic rituals or the murders. Detective Bill pops off and tells another officer, quote, Jesse is lying his ass off, end quote. After hours of questioning, Jesse starts telling officers what they want to hear. That he, Damien, and Jason did kill the 3 8-year-old boys. Here is a quote from Jesse about the questioning. Quote, I kept telling them I didn't know who did it. I just knew of it, what my friend had told me. But they kept hollering at me. They kept saying they know I had something to do with it because other people had told them. I told them what the 3 boys were wearing. Inspector Gary Mitchell told me, was any of them tied up? That's when I went along with him. I repeated what he said. I said, yes, they were. He asked me what they were tied up with, and I told him a rope. And he got mad. He said, quote, God damn it, Jesse, don't mess with me. No, they were tied up with shoestrings. I had to keep going through the story till I got it right. They hollered at me until I got it right. So whatever he told me, I'd start telling it back to him. But I figured something was wrong because if I'd have killed him, I'd have known how I done it. End quote. Keep in mind, Jesse has an IQ of 72. There were so many inconsistencies in Jesse's story until they were ironed out. And what he was saying matched the known facts of the case. Inconsistencies such as telling them that the murder happened during the day or that they had tied them up with rope. A little over 5 hours, they got Jesse's so-called confession. The confession tape is online, and if you Google it, you can find it. I personally don't believe anything he said. He basically said Damien Eccles hit Christopher Byers in the head while they were all in Robin Hood Woods, and that Jason Baldwin hit Stevie Branch. He says that Michael Moore took off running, and he, Jesse, chased him and grabbed him till they got there, then left. Jesse also said he came back to the scene a few minutes later, and all the boys were naked and tied up. He said, quote, they started screwing them and stuff, cutting them and stuff, end quote. And Jesse says that he took off running, telling Jason and Damien he just couldn't stay. Now, if you witnessed a murder, do you actually think somebody would let you run away and live to tell the story or tell anybody about it? I don't personally think so at all. Within hours of the confession, the police were able to get search warrants for the homes of Jesse, Jason, and Damien. And by 10:30 that night, on June 3rd, 1993, all 3 teenagers were arrested and charged with 3 counts of capital murder. Police decide to re-interview Vicky's 8-year-old son, Aaron. Oh, this kid. is a piece of work. Aaron now has a brand new story to tell, saying he was there when the three boys were killed and he witnessed it. Aaron said the night before the murders, Jesse called him and invited him to bring his three friends to the woods the next day, where they would all do, quote, something, quote. Aaron said Jesse slapped his friends, then, quote, I ran. Jesse caught me. I got away. He caught me again, and he tied me up. I, stayed there for about 40 seconds and got untied, end quote. When Inspector Gitchell asked Aaron what he was tied up with, he said a rope. Then said, quote, they couldn't hurt me because I kicked every one of them with a foot, end quote. This is frustrating, okay? I always want to trust the side of the kid. In this instance, his mother is also, let's just say, probably fueling this, and you'll see why later. You're wanting me to believe that this little boy that probably watched too many Bruce Lee movies got away from three murderers and they let him live. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Oh, so Gitchell was just so pleased that he now had a second eyewitness to the murders. However, little Aaron couldn't identify the assailants either. Imagine that. So on the next episode, I'm going to be breaking down the trial. It is pretty long. Jesse was tried separately, then Damien and Jason. So there were two separate trials. And we have a lot to unpack during these trials. When we are finished with it, I would love to know your thoughts and opinions, because what comes out in this trial is mind-blowing. Just keep an open mind through all of this and tell me what you think. You can tell me what you think about the episode so far. I do have a Facebook group that is called All the Things That Keep Us Up at Night Podcast. You can join there. We can talk about these cases and all the things that will be to come on the podcast and what you want to hear about. So stay tuned till next time. Thank you so much for listening. As always, stay safe, stay aware of your surroundings, and don't be a subject on my podcast. That's all I ask, because I love you. Thanks for listening.